From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past weekend's first round of the presidential election in France was the starting point for this conversation with Peter Laveau, the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. We spoke with Peter via Skype from Moscow Tuesday.
The French election for me was emblematic of exactly what's happening in Europe right now and an indication of how misleading Western media is. We have the winning candidate in the first round in France, Emmanuel Macron. You know, he's the liberal, the moderate, the European way, unity. It's all nonsense. Okay, it was a Hollywood PR job. Okay, Macron doesn't stand for anything. If he stood for anything, he was a minister in a former government where he was one of the most unpopular ministers for his very disastrous policies towards employment, particularly for young people. That is his claim to fame. But they did a good job on him. I mean, the entire corporate media sided with him, worked very hard to promote him. He is a non-entity. I mean, he was literally invented in a few months. It's really quite amazing. I mean, you got to tip your hat to the guys on Madison Avenue, or the French version thereof.
I mean, you've been seeing the same kind of thing play out in a number of countries, in Greece and Spain and Portugal. We saw around Europe kind of a polarization and also kind of like both sides against the middle dynamic too, with two on certain issues like relations with the EU. And you had, you know, Le Pen is a Eurosceptic, is one of the terms they use, talks about, you know, France's sovereignty and such in relation to the EU. And this time, a candidate of the far left, as he was positioned, came out the same way and got a good lift in the polls.
What we've had, and this is the culmination of the end of the Cold War, is we have essentially seen the disintegration of the traditional left and right political paradigm. And now we saw in this election in France that the left is finally retooling itself. I think the right has more issues and it'll be more difficult. But it's interesting is that when you have these new seeds on the left and the right, they're actually working together against a radical center. The center is what is radical today. The center is intolerant. And it's counterintuitive for most people to think about it because you think of the center as moderate. This is really the culmination of what we saw Bill Clinton do and Tony Blair in the U.S. and the U.K., destroying a traditional left. And Bernie Sanders is the iteration of the left trying to regenerate on its core issues. Now, in Europe here, it's far more complicated because I lived in Eastern Europe in the 1980s and early 90s. These are fundamentally conservative people, Don, very conservative. Mm-hmm. And this entire modernist agenda that's coming out of Brussels is terrifying them. And now you see like the Hungarian government being demonized because it doesn't toe the line, because they were said either you're with us or against us. I mean, that's very much Cold War rhetoric. You're in one camp or another. And a lot of Hungarians are saying, well, we're in Hungary and we want to stay in Hungary. And a lot of Greeks feel that way. And their elites just jumped forward and left the people behind. And this is what we're seeing. And we also are seeing that, and I think the Macron thing is fascinating because he has no answers for anything that I can tell. Heck, he hasn't even said very much, let alone now he's going to be the next president of the French Republic. This is extraordinary. So we're really seeing a lot of different trends colliding together. I can't even say I'm mildly optimistic about any kind of outcome, because a lot of the solutions that the political elites, particularly the what I call the Brussels aristocracy, they don't have any answers for the problems of everyday people. And the traditional left should be shamed of itself, absolutely shamed of leaving its core constituencies behind and buying into these this ideological project that the Brussels autocracy has been pushing. They're letting a lot of people down. This Macron thing is a disaster for Europe, but it is a victory. It's a victory for what the elites can do, the moneyed elites, the people in the deep state, and what the media can spin for you. I mean, what did they say in France? Macron's wife is what, like 24 years older than he is? I mean, it just turned into kind of like a dazzling wow story. That's not going to put young people to work. That's not going to stop the European Union and NATO getting involved in the affairs of foreign countries. I mean, this is like Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about really is that the issues that concern people across Europe and across the EU, issues of war and peace and, jobs and butter generally. I mean, they working class and middle class even have been facing austerity for quite a long time now, and they're in a fairly desperate condition. They're not concerned about whether a 15-year-old president, the current presidential candidate was dating his teacher back then and ended up marrying her. This doesn't put food on their table. It doesn't stop their kids from getting killed or from their money being squandered, blowing up places that they'll end up delivering a few hundred thousand refugees in gratitude.
These elections are not addressing real problems. Right. And, let's talk about Marine Le Pen. I'm not a supporter of Madame Le Pen, I never have been. I am very much for a more consolidated conservative coalition that would come about in France. If you look at the electoral map, it looks like Ukraine, really. Right. I mean, it's a very stark divide here. And I think it's really incumbent upon conservative parties to get their act together, too. Because when you have the deep state and you have the media on the liberal side, they can drive this, okay? It's smoke and mirrors. They make you cry through wonderful films and whatnot, like white helmets nonsense like that. But it's really a very important turning point, because I do believe that the traditional left and the traditional right had a very interesting coexistence, and they had to cooperate and they had to work together, and they did. I mean, look at the amazing achievements of the civil rights movement in the U.S. in the 1960s. I mean, that is something that every American should be proud of, okay? And it took a lot of real political wrangling to get that started. But now what we have is this radical center that is ideologically intolerant of any ideas coming from the outside. And if you do challenge, you're tarred one way or another. You're an anarchist or you're a fascist, okay? And most of the time it's neither, okay? Right. And going back to Madame Le Pen, it's time for her to step aside. It's time for, we don't need in France, we don't need a conservative coalition ruled by one family, okay? We don't. And I think it's time for her to move on. She not only came in second place, it was a disastrous second place. The fact that she came in second is the end of her political career. Now, I respect the fact that she resigned her position at the National Front, and she needs to be able to get – there are enough conservative forces in France that can start pushing back against this globalization, get control of their sovereignty again, have an honest – and I mean really honest and hard discussion and debate about immigration. Let's not all get hysterical about it. It's a very important issue. There are many immigrants that are in Europe right now that feel threatened by other immigrants as well. So let's not make this a certain white versus a non-white person. It's far more complicated than that. We're talking about levels of crime. We're talking about levels of employment. And every citizen of the sovereign states of Europe should have equal opportunity to all of those. Okay.
And by the way, why are the people there in the first place? You know how they got there? They were driven from their own countries by the war machines in these countries.
Absolutely. And that's why, Macron was the only one that's pro-war. Go figure. Go figure. The one that was only pro-war. It's amazing to me. That's how it was a bill of goods that was sold in a very sophisticated way without any substance. and just scaremongering. And I think this is really quite dreadful. Obviously, Macron doesn't have any policy. He has no movement. He has really no party. What will he do? What will he sacrifice? What will he give up to cobble together a coalition? I can give you the answer, Don. Anything they want from him.
Right.
Anything. He is the most powerless person in France right now. He has no leverage whatsoever. He can cherry pick a couple technocrats, and he can woo a few people from the left, a few people from the right, and say we're all in the center and we're all unified. Ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen because none of them have a coherent Fillon was the only one that had a coherent policy, and he actually was very skeptical of foreign wars, and he was actually open for having better relations with Russia. For that, they shot him down.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be a big issue for the elites there as well as here. And that's pretty frightening, actually, that there's such unanimity among various national elites on that point, that Russia is the enemy and there's not to be any dissent from that line. That's pretty scary.
It's really scary because it shows the utter weakness of the ruling political elites, because they don't have any answers, they don't have any explanations for what is going wrong and how they're culpable for it. And Russia's a very easy boogeyman. I mean, I have this, and maybe I'll send it to you and somehow you can get it out to your viewers. I have a collection of American, British and French, a little bit of Italian in between, drawings, political cartoons, we would call them today, from the 1850s to 1918. And you know what, Don? Russia's gone through a lot of different transitions, but the image of Russia is always the same. And I'm moving into a new apartment next year, and it's going to be, I'm going to devote my whole study to all the walls, to these portraits. I mean, I've been collecting them for a number of years now. It's really quite impressive. Wow. And I show them to people, and they're just astounded that the way the elites looked at Russia in 1850 was no different than they did in 1945. And now in 2017. It's really remarkable. No change.
So they haven't really been able
Russia
to invent.
Russia has changed immensely.
Right, exactly. I'm saying that. So they can't even invent a new story.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've got this election in France. The second round will be settled soon enough. It's going to be one or the other of these two, unless something happens in the intervening period. And probably not Le Pen, right? Is that your read of this?
My reading of it is that, because of her first result, I mean, she had to get in the area of 26-27% to get some kind of gravitas. Now, she was well short of that. And it shows that, first of all, she didn't run as good a campaign as she should. I mean, and at the same time, I mean, the whole system is stacked against her, okay?
Right, right,
or against
right.
The National Front, because I really want to separate the two, because there are issues in the National Front that I absolutely agree with. There are things that I would question very much, but it's not all about one person. And I think that that's part of this tarring of conservatives. I keep using the word conservatives and not the right, because I think people are conflating the two. All through Europe and in the United States, in the UK, there are rightist forces that you and I have nothing to do with, and we have no conversation with them, okay? Right. But I, as a conservative, I can talk to liberals and progressives without any problem, as long as there's no ideological rigidity. And of course, for you and I, there's no place for any form of racism.
Yeah,
that's spoken. That's obvious.
Of course not.
But, there's no path forward, if we can use that phrase, for her. I can't see it. But what I do see is that if she can get up to 40%, that would be a huge victory for her. She would not become president of the French Republic. But that would send the message to the elites that there are people out there that are not going to have this all shoved down their throat. And that's when it's going to start the path of slowly but surely talking about issues of sovereignty. There is a significant percentage of the French population that very much question France's role in NATO. Many are very, very concerned about more foreign wars because it brings in immigrants. I mean, it's such a simple thing. I mean, why should people be bombed? Why should European countries bomb predominantly Muslim states and then force them to live in a foreign country where they may not particularly be welcomed? We need to take a huge step back and look at that kind of logic there because they're not doing it. On the issue of Russia, well, it's just going to stay the way it is. And I can tell our listeners here, Putin wanted to be friends with Trump. Putin had hope for it's all nonsense. Don, the Russian political elite don't trust Western political elites at all, at all. And it's not about Ukraine. It's all about Yugoslavia. When Primakov was flying to the United States and he was going to stand next to Vice President Al Gore and they were going to have a peace process for Yugoslavia, and when the foreign minister Primakov was over the Atlantic, the Americans under the aegis of NATO started bombing Yugoslavia. And you know what? That's when Primakov said, turn the plane around. We're going back to Moscow. That's day one of this distrust of the West. And it's never recovered from that. They openly lied about it. It's not because of Ukraine. It's not because of Syria. It's not because of Russiagate and all of that. No, it's much deeper than that. And the Russian side just wants a coherent interlocutor to work with. What's your vision? Because look what Lavrov had to do with that bozo, Kerry. I mean, Kerry just he was talking out of both sides of his mouth at the same time. Nobody in Russia knew what he was talking about. He can't be trusted. And this is how the Russian political elite looks at the Western political elite. They're not trustworthy because they know that this is on the Russian side. They know it's a huge amount of cynicism. They're being cynical, using it for domestic purposes. I mean, why is Donald Trump calling all of the American senators to the White House to talk about North Korea? I mean, if he doesn't do something, Don, he's going to look pretty stupid. Yeah. Right. So the optics of all of this is very, very scary. Okay. Yeah. You call 100 senators together and then you don't do anything. And that's what the Russians said back in September of last year, you know, Kerry, we have a peacekeeping, we have a ceasefire in Syria. You know, we're going to start trading more information. We're going to start coordinating our attacks against real terrorists. And then Ash Carter bombs the Syrian army. Well, what do you think the Russians are supposed to think? You know? So for me, any kind of thaw, and God forbid we ever use the term reset again, it's out in the future. And I can tell you most people here don't think about it much. It's it was a fly in the pan. I mean, it's just, who cares? The Americans can't make up their mind what they want.
I hope they don't bust out another one of those big red plastic buttons whenever they call it going forward if they get to that point. The image of that you paint with the imagery of Russia as the character or characterization of it, a caricature of it that's almost unchanged over a couple of centuries, which betrays really the eye of the person looking at Russia rather than something about the nature of Russia. The observer rather. So you have this caricature still there, this demonization at full steam. This elite in a crisis of being able to solve its own fundamental problems. I mean, the elites here are pointing at Russia right now because they're trying to deflect attention from themselves, as the people here are in states of precariousness across the board, economically, looking at possibility of war, you know, all kinds of really scary environment for people here with an elite that can't solve that problem, and they're focusing this imagery on Russia. I mean, is it inevitable that there's going to be a war?
Well, I think we should be very careful. Nothing is inevitable. Right. But what is worrisome is that we can see miscalculation. I'll tell you the way the Russians see it. the Americans say they want to, at one point in time or another, they want to have some kind of settlement in Syria, and then the Americans sabotage it. We have ample evidence that the United States was involved in the illegal overthrow of the government in Ukraine in 2014. We see an energy policy coming out of the think tankistan in the U.S. that is just denying Russia any kind of agency in its own energy security policy. I mean, it's just so patently obvious. And so, you know, if there's this complete disregard and contempt for Russia's demanding to decide its own national interests, then we go down this very dangerous path. Because if there is no regard for it, then you plan to have the Russians eventually surrender. We're just going to make them surrender. You know what? That's never going to happen. That's never going to happen. And Russia is defensively prepared. I suggest our listeners, let's go over to the website, the Vineyard Saker. He's a brilliant analyst. Mm. And look at some of his articles on Russia's security architecture, what kind of protocols it has. He speaks Russian, obviously. He lives in the U.S. And he basically says, you know, Russia is prepared to fight a defensive war, and it will go nuclear if it has to survive. Now, just think about that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Because the United States, its military, over the last 25 years, has been geared to regime change and to counterinsurgency, which I say in inverted commas because most of it is just a farce. But, you know, Mr. Petraeus made a name out of it. But the U.S. military is not actually capable to deal with a country like Russia. Russia has a defensive military capacity. It has very little ability to project military power, believe it or not, because that's not what its military doctrine is.
It's not its task, right?
Its task is to be able to, if necessary, to project military power with about 1,500 kilometers from its border, from the hinterland. Now, that if you take a map, that includes Syria, but that doesn't include Yemen. It doesn't include Libya. It doesn't include these places. And so people are saying, well, why doesn't Russia and Putin stand up for this? But his military doctrine, his generals are saying, look, with our resources and our abilities, this is what we can do.
Right.
And
right.
Why do we want to be any more involved in other people's affairs? We want, you know, this ridiculous allegations, the Russians are aiding and arming the Taliban. This is insanity. Look, last month, Moscow asked international players, come to Kabul, let's sit down, let's start talking. The Russians talk to the Taliban. Yes, they do, for negotiations.
Right.
Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, Russia can talk to more people in the world than the Americans can now. Okay, so, you know, this misperception that Russia is just looking for trouble and meddling in all these places, elections in Europe, so what? Who cares the outcome of the election in Europe? Russia is going to deal with whatever government is there. And that's its position. You know, there are two pro-Russia websites in France. It's RT and Sputnik.
Right, right.
We're moving the world. Two websites
in
France.
The power of those
extraordinary.
Two, yes. I know.
Come on.
Yeah, there's an interesting discussion of that in your most recent crosstalk. I enjoyed very much pointing out exactly that. You had you have RT and Sputnik in France, the French language versions of it, and supposedly those two outlets, compared to all the French language outlets, all the national ones, all of the European media in French language, all of the former French colonies in French language, all of those dwarfed by the influence of RT and Sputnik. You and Dmitry Babich should get a huge raise.
I'll send the word along. Thanks, Don.
And I'd like to act as your agent as we draft that.
You'll get a piece. You'll get a good piece then.
Cool. So look, we're looking at this kind of, you know, chaotic situation in the international scene, at least in terms of the behavior of the West. And, you know, they've been, in fact, somebody cited this, I don't know if it was you or Dmitry Babich or Mark Sloboda or the French journalist that you had. Somebody spoke of the Guns of August, the book from 1962 that Kennedy was actually talking about during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where World War I was the result of a series of miscalculations, people thinking that they had insights into the other side that no longer applied, and all these different things. And I mean, we're looking at exactly that kind of scenario with some of the things that you've described, like with Kerry, you know, pulling that stuff in front of, you know, the world, and what they did with President Xi, what Trump did a week or two ago, the same. There's no rules. People can't trust anything.
One of the things going, I was the one that mentioned the Guns of August.
Yeah.
And one of the things, one of the layers of the Guns of August, and we remind everybody, this was the breakout of the First World War. And one of the interesting layers that has to be remembered is the issue of prestige. Mm. And every major country did not want to lose face. When you had the case of I think it was in 1913, Austria annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina. And that really annoyed the Russians, but the Russians did nothing. And then we had the revolution of 1905, and then we had the Russo-Japanese War. And so, and then you have the Germans being very, very aggressive, finding its place in the sun. You have the French that see themselves threatened by Germany's rise because the international order was not designed for a middle European power. And then you have the British that want to stay number one and will always go in to tip the balance against one side or the other. And so it gets extremely complicated, and then it gets down to who's going to lose face. And the reason why I kind of dwell on this a little bit is that I look at President Trump, and he's coming in from behind. He's got to prove himself, and he may have to prove himself to the day he leaves office or the day he's forced to leave office. And I see the Tomahawk missiles. I see the Armada going to Korea. North Korea is not a threat to the United States. North Korea actually is not really a threat to South Korea. Believe me. It's not a threat to any of its neighbors. It is defensive. Yes, it's bombastic and bellicose rhetoric is there. But, you know, anyone that's been watching the Northeast Pacific for the last 25 years, we get this every year, every other year. Okay. And the fact of the matter is if there was any meaningful offensive campaign coming out of North Korea towards one of its neighbors, North Korea would be incinerated in about 40 minutes.
Right. And they know. Yeah.
And they know that. Right. And the regime in North Korea has one goal and one goal only: regime survival.
Right.
It's not going to risk regime survival. Okay? It's not going to do that. The miscalculation and the prestige issue is here is that Donald Trump got annoyed by the North Korean leader. Well, he annoys everybody. That's what he's there for. That he's supposed to taunt the world. Okay. Basically, it's hello, everyone. We're still here. We're still here. Okay. And it's always that. The Chinese know it better than anyone else. So this obsession with prestige and your poll numbers back home blind you to the foreign policy dangers that are out there and that are being compounded because you're looking in the wrong direction. And you know, I like you. You and I are very, very strong anti-war people, and I do worry, obviously, seeing so many generals in running American foreign policy right now. These people are to military by nature is to solve problems. They're not by nature to create strategies that are multifaceted with soft power, with economic power, with diplomacy, public policy. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are New Age generals out there that I don't know about.
No,
but awesome. You know, I've used this metaphor before. But these people, they're hammers, and all they see in the world is nails.
Right.
The world is not made of nails only.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.